With our guest tonight, Michael Cremo, Forbidden Archaeology, his latest work, My Science, My Religion, and he'll explain all about that in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, one of our favorite guests here on Coast to Coast AM, Michael Cremo, member of the History of Science Society, the World Archaeological Congress, and a research associate in history and philosophy of science as well. Well-known author, some of his books, The Hidden History of the Human Race, Forbidden Archaeology's Impact, Forbidden Archaeology, Human Devolution, and the latest, My Science, My Religion. Welcome back to Coast AM, Michael Cremo. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing just fine, George. Good to be with you and all the Coast to Coast listeners.
We're looking forward to this. This is going to be fun. You're working some. And I also wanted to ask you something about the Vermanas, those flying machines, before we really get going here.
Sure.
What did the ancient texts in India say about them?
Well, they gave elaborate descriptions of different kinds of flying machines that existed in ancient times. Some of them were mechanical devices made of metals like iron. An example of that was the Vimana that appeared about 5,000 years ago over the city of Dwarka, which is still there in northwestern India. There's still a city of that name. And off the shore, there is a sunken city under the water that may be the remains of the city that was there 5,000 years ago. But it's described that 5,000 years ago, this Vimana, which came from the skies, attacked this city of Dwarka, raining down different types of weapons on it. But it was shot down. It was the city of Lord Krishna, and according to the ancient Sanskrit writings, he shot it down and it crashed into the sea off the coast of the city. So I don't know, maybe the remains are still there under the water.
It could be. Do you believe that actually they had flying machines in that time?
Actually, I do. I think they had all kinds of different sorts of flying machines. Some of these Vimanas, as I said, were made of metal. They were mechanical devices. Other ones appear to be more interdimensional in that they were made of more subtle kinds of energies, and yet they could travel to different dimensions in the cosmos, ultimately completely beyond all the levels of material reality. So there are different types of them described. And one of the reasons why I accept that is we find that the descriptions given in these ancient texts, which are thousands of years old, match the kinds of descriptions that we get from modern observations of UFOs. So the flight patterns, for example, are similar. Many of the observers of modern UFOs say they behave in ways that appear contrary to the laws of physics. I remember once I was giving a lecture about my work in Germany. This was a few years ago, and it just so happened that one of the people attending the lecture was a pilot from an American airline. You know, he was flying 747s across the Atlantic, and he told me that on one occasion he saw a UFO coming straight at him at a high rate of speed, and then just shortly before it came to the 747, it went straight up into the air. And then so the flight characteristics that are described in the ancient writings sort of match what modern observers are also telling us. Another thing that modern observers tell us come from radar reports of UFOs. And sometimes they appear to be giving more than one radar signal. In other words, sometimes they appear to be able to produce more than one image, radar image, which would tend to confuse you about where the real one is. And this is also reported in connection with that Vimana that attacked the city of Dwarka, that it would appear, sometimes appear to be several places at the same time. So these are some of the reasons why I accept the account of the Vimanas as true.
Mm-hmm.
The textual evidence is there, which I find credible, but also it matches up with the kinds of observations that modern observers are giving us about these kinds of things.
Where did they go, Michael? What happened to them?
Well, I think they're still around because there's still reports of them. I don't think they've completely vanished. Now, they may not be visible at all times to everyone, but there are enough reports today from credible observers that lead me to think, well, these aren't just things that existed only in ancient times. Great. They're still around today.
Great, thanks. Now, your latest work, of course, My Science, My Religion. Tell me about the title.
Well, this is a collection of 24 papers that I've presented at major international scientific conferences. Of course, here on Coast to Coast, we talk about a lot of unusual subjects. And some people might think it's only on Coast to Coast that I talk about these things. But I also talk about these same topics at major international scientific conferences. And I am very clear that a lot of my ideas have some root in ideas that come from my spiritual commitments, from my religious commitments. Now, there's some people who think you should not mix spirituality and science. I don't accept that idea. I think if we're going to have a complete picture of reality, we have to accept truth wherever it comes from. It may come from religion, it may come from science, but if we're going to have a complete picture of reality, I think we have to take advantage of all available sources of knowledge. Now, some people, they speak about science and religion in general terms.
Right.
But I called that book My Science, My Religion because I wanted to let people know what my specific interests in science are and what my specific commitments on the spiritual side are. So I've always been very clear. We started talking here about Vimanas, or spacecraft that are described in the ancient spiritual writings of India. So that's where I've gotten some of my ideas about that topic. So similarly, I've gotten a lot of my ideas about human origins and antiquity that I talked about in Forbidden Archaeology from the ancient Sanskrit writings as well. So I wanted to give people a better background. If anybody does go through the book, they'll get a rather complete background of exactly what my spiritual commitments are, what my application of those in the world of science is in a lot of different areas. And as I said, some people may think this is a bit unusual, but these are papers, 24 papers that I presented at major international scientific conferences where I'm very open about my science and my religion.
You know, let's talk a little bit about these papers that you've accumulated over the years and, you know, putting them into perspective with your work, My Science, My Religion. Did you, during the course of your career, Michael, ever come into any personal conflicts with your belief system?
Of course, every day you know, I'm confronted with things which conflict with my belief system, but or with people who conflict with it. But I've also learned that it's, if you look at everything, if you look at just what's in the textbooks, you find a lot that would conflict with a genuine spiritual worldview.
True.
But I found if you look at all the evidence, then it doesn't. For example, and when I started studying the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, especially the Puranas or the historical writings, I learned about human populations that existed on Earth going back many millions and millions of years, right back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. That certainly conflicted with everything I had learned from my teachers in high school and university.
It tore everything up, didn't it?
Yes, it did. But if you just looked at what's in the textbooks, you would think, well, the information that's given in those ancient Sanskrit writings is simply mythology. So you could say, well, there would be a big conflict between, you know, what science says and what your spiritual leanings are. So how to deal with that? So the way I dealt with it was, let me look and see what all the evidence is, not just what's in the textbooks. That led me into researching the whole history of archaeology and looking into the original scientific reports. And when I did that, I found huge amounts of evidence that supported what the ancient Sanskrit writings were telling me. And I put all that evidence together in my first major work, Forbidden Archaeology. And so I find it's important to look at the complete range of scientific evidence. If you look just at what's in the textbooks today, you're going to get a very narrow selection of that complete set of evidence. And it may appear to conflict with, say, the beliefs one may get from a spiritual tradition or a religious tradition.
Michael, as you look toward what you've researched and then toward the future, have you changed your mind at all on anything?
On major points, no. I mean, do you mean, I'm trying to understand your question, George.
In terms of
before I adopted my spiritual worldview, did my ideas change?
Yeah, like when you wrote Forbidden Archaeology, years later, did you see anything that would change your thoughts on things, or have you just kept moving forward?
Well, in terms of Forbidden Archaeology, actually, yes. There is one thing that I've changed my mind about. This is it's kind of a technical point, but let me try to explain it.
Okay.
When I wrote Forbidden Archaeology, I accepted the modern scientific idea that anatomically modern human beings are a separate species from different types of what were called ape men, Neanderthals, Homo erectus, and things like that. But since that time, I've come to accept that a lot of those creatures that we now think are different species, like the Neanderthals and the Homo erectus, are actually just another variety of human being. And one reason I came to that conclusion was looking at modern reports from physical anthropologists that demonstrate there are living people today who have some of the features, skeletal features, of these so-called different species like Homo erectus and Neanderthal. You know, for example, big brow ridges. There are living people today who have them. So unless we're going to say that the current human population existing on the world today should be divided up into different species, we shouldn't divide these species that existed in the past into different species either. So that's one change that's come about in, since I wrote Forbidden Archaeology, that I'm starting to look a little differently at these creatures that are now assigned to different species, like Neanderthals and Homo erectus. I think it may be more correct to make them subspecies, like Homo sapiens neanderthalensis or Homo sapiens erectus, rather than calling them separate species like Homo erectus and Neanderthal. So it's a technical point, but that is an idea that I have found myself changing from the time I wrote Forbidden Archaeology to the present. And that's going to be reflected in a follow-up book to Forbidden Archaeology that I'm in the process of putting together now.
Oh, good. Good. Now, the tell me about the papers that were the basis of My Science, My Religion.
Well, I'll start with the first one. The first time I presented a scientific paper at a major international scientific conference was in 1994. It was a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress that took place in New Delhi, India. Now, the World Archaeological Congress is one of the world's largest international organizations of professional archaeologists, and they meet every 4 years in a different country. Actually, in January, I was at the meeting of the World Archaeological Congress that took place at the Dead Sea in Jordan, and we could talk about that a little bit later. That was very interesting.
Sure.
I went to Petra, that very famous archaeological site in Jordan. But this meeting of the World Archaeological Congress that took place in 1994 took place in New Delhi, India. And I thought this would be the perfect opportunity to present a summary of my work in Forbidden Archaeology. So I presented a paper there. Well, I proposed a paper called Puranic Time and the Archaeological Record. So the Puranas, as I mentioned a little earlier, were the historical writings of ancient India, and they're based on a cyclical concept of time. Time goes in vast cycles. A lot of the ancient people had that idea. The Mayans had that idea, the Greeks, the Romans. Practically, they all had a cyclical concept of time, a little bit different from the modern linear concept of time. And these cycles go for millions and millions of years. But according to the Puranas, humans were present throughout all those different cycles going back millions and millions of years. So I presented a paper, I proposed a paper called Puranic Time and the Archaeological Record, because I wanted to show there was actually archaeological evidence that showed that the account of extreme human antiquity in...
Hold on, Michael. We're going to let you finish up on that one, and then we'll get into more of your papers. My Science, My Religion with Michael Cremo on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you haven't taken advantage of our 10-day free offer to look at our television program, please go ahead and take advantage of it. And also look at all the videos you can during those 10 days. Go to GaiamTV.com/George, GaiamTV.com/George. Program runs on Friday, 7 o'clock Eastern time, and you can watch it right off your computer or plug your smartphone into your flat screen. You could watch it that way as well. It's pretty exciting stuff, so go take a look at it. 10 days free. You can also get the link at hosts when you go to coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back, Michael Cremo with us. Michael, we were talking about the papers that you used, your scientific reports, and I'll let you finish up on that first story.
Yeah, the first scientific paper I presented was called Puranic Time and the Archaeological Record. I presented it at a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress that was held in New Delhi, India in 1994. And that paper was not only accepted for presentation at this major international scientific conference, it was later published in a peer-reviewed conference proceedings volume called Time and Archaeology, which came out from Routledge, a major scientific publisher. So many times, you know, people ask me, do you have peer-reviewed scientific publications? And, you know, the answer is yes, and this is one of them. It happened to be the first paper that I presented at a major international scientific conference. And it had to do with archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity, archaeological evidence showing that humans like us have existed for millions and millions of years. And of course, we talk a lot about these things on coast to coast, but I'm also speaking to them at major international scientific conferences.
Michael, when you look at this work, and you know, people will question, come on, is humankind really that old? What do you say to them?
Well, it's a question that's very important. The answer to that question, you know, who are we, where did we come from, is going to determine a lot of things because it has to do with our identity. You know, who am I? Where did I come from? Based on my understanding of these things, I form my goals, my ambitions, my values. So it's pretty important that we have a correct understanding of these things. You know, for example, if a person doesn't understand who he is or where he is, he's going to get in trouble. He's going to cause problems for himself, problems for others. So I think it's important that we have the right answers to these questions, and that's ultimately what this is all about. It's not simply a question for a few ivory tower scientists to argue about, you know, are we 100,000 years old or a few million years old? It's not, you know, just a question of how many years, but what it adds up to, if we have been here for millions and millions of years, going all the way back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth, that means our current scientific understandings of who we are and where we came from are wrong.
Yes.
And that has some important implications because at the present moment, most scientists are telling us we're just machines made of matter. We're evolved apes that came into existence by a purely materialistic process of evolution about 100 or 200,000 years ago. And that means we can account for our existence in purely materialistic terms. We're just machines made of molecules. And I think that that worldview, that sense of identity has some very bad implications for us individually and collectively in our world today, because what it means is, well, our goals become purely materialistic. We think we're not just machines made of matter. We're machines made of matter in competition with each other for survival. So I think this breeds intense levels of conflict of the kind that we see in the world today. I think it's one of the underlying causes of the environmental destruction that this planet is undergoing. I think it's also one of the things that underlies the financial crises that the world is subjected to. Because if we are just machines made of matter in competition with each other for economic and physical and cultural survival, then some people are going to take unfair advantage of others. And that's what happens. That's why we have a financial crisis. That's why we have a political crisis. That's why we have a crisis of the environment. So I think it's important to understand who we really are. And part of that is understanding how ancient we are. Because if we really are very ancient, then that means we have to think of new explanations for human origins and antiquity. And I think those new explanations are going to have to involve some non-material elements.
If we're right, Michael, about the age of humankind, why has science gotten it so wrong?
I think there are a lot of reasons for that. One of them is that the supporters of the current theories now have a government-enforced monopoly in the education systems. So only their ideas can be taught. So it's not really possible for teachers to question them in the education system. If they do it, you know, then they find themselves removed from their positions or told they can't do that. It's against the law to question, say, the theory of evolution. You cannot question the Darwinian theory of evolution in the nation's schools and the public tax-supported education system. You can't do that. So I think that's one reason. And I think it also has to do with power. You know, people who have power don't like to give it up very much, particularly those who have monopoly power. So the supporters of the current theories now have a government-enforced monopoly in the education system. So, of course, they're reluctant to give up their ideas or even consider the possibility that they might be wrong and that it might be possible for alternatives to be presented and let people make up their own minds about that. I respect the right of each individual to make up his or her own mind about, you know, this question of human origins, but the people who are now in charge of the education system don't really respect that right. They think only one idea about human origins should be presented to people, and they shouldn't have any alternatives to choose among. So I think eventually that has to change. And I think one of the reasons why they resist the evidence that contradicts the current theories, in addition to these power considerations, is that they know that the alternatives are going to lead in a more spiritual direction. There are going to be ideas that involve intelligent agency being responsible in some degree for our origin. They're going to involve things like a non-material conscious self that can exist apart from the body. And if those ideas were accepted, I think we would see a different kind of society than the one that's dominant today. I think we would see a society where there is more balance between the material and spiritual aspects of life, where people would be putting more energy into developing the resources of consciousness rather than just trying to exploit, dominate, and control the resources of matter. So that process of dominating, controlling, and exploiting the resources of matter generates huge amounts of wealth. So, of course, they want to see that system continue. You know, they don't want to see people get off the rat race and start putting energy into things that aren't going to be contributing.
They want that status quo that they control.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's ultimately it.
The humankind, if we're, let's say, 100 million years old, planted here or developed here?
Ultimately, I would say planted, because we, according to the ideas that I present in my books like Human Devolution and the papers that I presented at some scientific conferences, the bodies that we have, whether they're plant or animal or human, are vehicles for conscious selves. The conscious self, or to use a religious term, the soul, is non-material. and the body made of matter is just a vehicle for it to use in the world of matter. But that conscious self, who is what we really are the conscious self, that has an origin beyond the world of matter. So that means we're all extraterrestrials. We've all been seeded into this universe. And when I say seed, the seed is that conscious self, that individual conscious self. There's a Sanskrit word for it called the Atma or the Jiva. That is non-material. It comes from a non-material level of reality. So we've been seeded into this level of reality because we cannot exist in the harmonious state of pure consciousness, which is our original state. If you know, we, by misusing our free will, decide to become selfish, egotistical, then we can no longer exist in that harmonious original state, and we need a place where we can act out our selfish desires, and that's this world. Of course, within this world, there are two types of conscious selves. There's the type that's trying to get more and more deeply into domination, control, conflict, exploitation, and all of that. And we see a lot of that going on in the world around us. And then the other type is the type that's trying to understand, what am I really? I'm a being of pure consciousness. All others are beings of pure consciousness. We're meant to be living in harmony with each other, not dividing ourselves into different conflicting groups. So I would say, in answer to your question, well, we were seated here and we were given vehicles to allow us to act out our desires on this level of reality. But those vehicles, especially this human vehicle, can be used for two purposes. That this human vehicle can be used to go back to our original source, or it can be used to get deeper and deeper into domination, control, exploitation, conflict, selfishness, greed, and all of that, which we see a lot of.
Michael, could there be remnants on the moon of us, past civilizations with high technology, who've already been there?
I think the answer to that is yes. And one thing, however, that I consider is that this universe that we live in is a multi-level universe. There are different levels, energy levels in this universe. Right now, we are existing on this level, which is a very dense level of gross material energy. So our technology on this level is relatively gross. You know, we dig metal out of the ground, we refine it, we put it together in the form of different machines, and we power those machines with oil that we dig up or suck up out of the ground and refine. And you know, it's a very crude kind of technology, in my opinion. On some of these higher levels of the cosmos, they deal with more subtle energies, with, you know, mental energies. There's a kind of subtle machinery that they have. So I think on the moon, we're going to find, you know, according to most ancient wisdom traditions, the moon and other planets are on a higher energy level, still a material energy level, but a more subtle material energy level than we are on here. So the technologies that they have on that level may be somewhat different than the kinds of technology that we manufacture on Earth. But yes, I would say they not only were once there, they're still there today.
Michael, what happened to them? Catastrophes? I mean, if we're that old, and I tend to believe you that we are, something happened. And it could have happened several times. I mean, we've probably have had civilization-ending catastrophes a half a dozen times.
I actually believe that. The concept of time, according to the ancient Sanskrit writings that have inspired a lot of my work, is cyclical. And in the course of cyclical time, there are or have been periodic catastrophes. And it's interesting that you mentioned the term half a dozen, because I think that's exactly right. And let me tell you why I think that. The basic unit of cyclical time, according to the ancient Sanskrit writings, is called the kalpa. It's in English, it would be called the day of Brahma. And it lasts about 4 billion years. It's divided into 14 subcycles called manvantars. And according to the Vedic cosmological calendar, we're now in the seventh manvantar of the current kalpa, or day of Brahma. And that means there have been six manvantars before us. And according to the ancient Sanskrit writings, after each manvantar, there is a devastation which wipes out life on Earth. However, life is preserved on higher levels of the cosmos. So after the catastrophes that affect life on Earth and wipe it out, it can be repopulated by beings who exist on these higher levels. It's sort of like cloud computing. You know, there are a lot of systems today whereby you can store your computer files on what they call the cloud. In other words, not on your device that you have in your office or your home or you carry around with you, but on the web, somewhere in the cloud, so that if your computer or phone or laptop or tablet is destroyed, you can download your files and programs from the cloud. So I think the universe is set up like that. There are periodic catastrophes that take place, and there have been, in the course of the past 2 billion years, six major catastrophes, according to the ancient Sanskrit writings. And according to modern paleontology, in the course of the past 2 billion years, there have been six major extinction events that have taken place in the history of life on Earth. And these extinction events have wiped out most of the species that were existing at these times, after which life had to re-expand again on Earth. So whether we're looking at what modern science tells us or at what ancient wisdom traditions tell us, there have, I believe, been periodic catastrophes mm-hmm. that have affected life on Earth. Now, you know, some people thought maybe in December of last year there was going to be such a catastrophe. I think that's eventually going to happen.
I think so too.
You know, I was in last
probably
year,
sooner than later, Michael.
Well, I'll tell you when I think it'll happen.
All right, hold on, because you're going to have to hold that for us when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.